right, let's talk about how to build white matter in your brain. If you're going to build white matter in your brain, it's important to make sure we build white matter around the habits of emotional maturity and not emotional immaturity. So, in other words, if you need to move up to adult level, then you're going to want to look at what it looks like to be an adult maturity level. These are emotional maturity levels. An intelligence maturity level that would allow you to be a nuclear scientist, but still be a child emotional maturity, right? So don't miss, or you could be a professional athlete that wins all kinds of whatever, right? But still have a child emotional maturity level. So just remember that when you're looking at it. That's why you can be high functioning if you have other ways to cope and to do your life. But when you're building these healthy habits, look at what the next level of maturity is for your emotional maturity and incorporate those into your habit. So here's how you're going to build the white matter. Number one, appreciation, 15 minutes a day, every day, you're forming a habit. Just practice speaking out loud what you're thankful for, what you appreciate. And it works even better if you'll do it in the same location. You don't have to, but it becomes even more autopilot if you, every time you get in your car, you start saying what you're thankful for. Or when you drink your cup of coffee in the morning, whatever you're appreciating. You know, get it in some kind of routine. Number two, take 5 minutes three times a day to simply think about what makes you happy. The more time you spend in appreciation, the more your joy capacity will grow. So what makes you happy? What makes you feel joy? Both of those. You know, remember, happiness is not the same thing as joy. Number three, get your thoughts in sync with Yahweh's thoughts. Our ability to experience peace depends on our ability to be single-minded. When my thoughts are going right and Yahweh's thoughts are going left, I'm going to be double-minded, which means I will be unstable in all my ways. So number four, identify what drains your joy, such as sickness, lack of sleep, lack of exercise, poor diet, relational issues, unresolved problems, recent loss, etc. Recognizing that something has drained our joy means that we need to do something to refuel our joy tank. Ask yourself, what is life giving to you? So you need to know both. You need to know what drains your tank and what fills your tank. And once you know what those are, make sure you have those in your diet, your regular diet, so to speak. Number five, avoid joy substitutes. Those are addictions. Things such as food, substance, entertainment, internet, phone, people, adrenaline, pornography, shopping, and so much more. In other words, your beeps. General protector leaders build joyful relationships and practice and teach ways to return to joy in the midst of hardships. They know how to keep relationships bigger than the problem. The key to enduring hardship is relational joy. Both the Babel. Babel. both the Bible and neuroscience confirm this. All right. Question over here.
It's not a question, it's a statement. But number three, get your thoughts in sync with Yahweh's thoughts. Our ability to experience peace depends on our ability to be single-minded. In my opinion, that is one of the places that myself as well as others are the most deceived, thinking that I can be all in with Yahweh and have all these thoughts and all these things I'm doing over here, and it's okay. Like, double-minded is if I want to murder you and kill you, then I'm double-minded. But it's the little things that steal me and steals it away.
That if you're faithful in the small things, you'll be faithful with much. How do you know when something is an addiction? I mean, I eat food, and I love to talk to people on the phone. Sometimes I'll do that when I'm working on something else, just to kind of keep myself entertained. How do you know when something's an addiction? Addiction tends to compel you. You don't want to live without it. You turn to it. You turn to it instead of turning to the Lord, or you turn to it for comfort, pleasure, entertainment. You're bored, you know, instead of the Lord. It's kind of like an idol. It's very much like an idol, something you use to get your needs met apart from the Lord. David.
I don't know, just in relation to that, could we say, you know, the addiction, it doesn't satisfy, whereas if it's not an addiction, like if we're doing it along with Yahweh, there's it satisfies? Is that, I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't satisfy the flesh necessarily, yeah. So I'm not quite sure how to.
An addiction does satisfy in the moment, but it doesn't meet the need, really. It doesn't fix anything. So you have to keep doing it. And an addiction tends to be compelling. You think about it. You want it. And if you do it, an addiction becomes a habit. It becomes hardwired. You don't even have to think about it to do it, usually. Okay. And, you know, yeah, we all have to eat, and yeah, we all are supposed to interact with people, but there can be, just like with using food for comfort, using people for comfort to meet our needs, it all depends on your motive, why you're doing it. Why are you, and is the Lord telling you to do something other than that? Like, you spend all your time, I'm not saying you, I'm just saying we spend all our time over here with people, and then we go, I don't have any time to be with the Lord. So. Okay, all right. Assessing your emotional maturity. So we're going to look at some assessments here. You are. And page 168. Why is assessing your emotional maturity important? So assessments help you choose mature people for leadership positions. So you can use these assessments for yourself. You can use them for other people. If you're a leader and you're trying to put somebody in a position, You want to know what their emotional maturity level is. When you put gifted, intelligent, well-educated, and emotionally immature people into leadership positions, you set your group up for difficulties. Number two, assessments help to create a foundation for authenticity. We all have areas of weakness. When everyone is honest about their areas of need, transparency becomes normal, and an environment for healing and maturing can be established. This also communicates to the group that it's okay to be weak and in need, which removes any shame from being honest. Number three, assessments help us to know which skills are missing and which we need to work on. This helps us form a strategy for personal growth and development. Assessments help us show tenderness toward weakness. Leaders who focus on problems tend to use assessments to punish people for their weakness. Relationally focused leaders use assessments to learn how to help people grow. Assessments help us to be more effective in discipleship. Knowing where people are weak helps us know where they need our protection and encouragement. It's important to point out that we don't assess maturity in order to judge or control people. We do it so we can be as helpful to them as possible. All right, four core qualities of emotional maturity that can be used as a guide to assess your own maturity and also the maturity of the people that you're partnering with. Number one, do you avoid conflict? Number two, do you avoid people who upset you? Number three, do you use negative emotions, such as shame, anger, fear, disgust, to control people or the outcomes? If so, you value resolving problems more than remaining relational. Number four, when conflict arises, do you make people choose sides, or do you reach out to those who oppose you? Making people choose sides is a problem-solving action, not a relationship-building strategy. All right, the first assessment, and I'm going to encourage you, first thoughts are usually more accurate, because once you've thought about it, you talk yourself into another answer often. So I'm going to read the questions and go with your gut level first response, and you know, you can write it in your book or not, but be honest and look at these questions. Let's see. Here we go. Number one, do people walk on eggshells around you? Number two, do they feel safe disagreeing with you, or do they keep their opinions to themselves? Number three, do they share their honest opinions regularly, or do they wait to see which direction you want the discussion to go before they commit to a position? Number four, do people avoid sharing their problems with you? Can they expect a tender response to their weaknesses, or do they fear any signs of weakness will be used against them? Do you reveal your weaknesses and ask others for help? Do you fear people discovering what you are truly thinking or feeling about the problems you're facing? Do you often present yourself as stronger than you really feel? Okay, returning to joy assessment questions. We return to joy by maintaining our capacity to be relational and act like ourselves during times of upset. Instead of shutting down important parts of our personality. Number one, do you know how to quiet yourself when your emotions get upset? Do you quiet well with others, or do you isolate yourself during upsetting emotions? Do you reestablish relational connection quickly after upset emotions? Or do strong negative emotions control your relationships for entire days, weeks, or even months? Number four, do you help others return to authentic relationship quickly from their unpleasant emotion? Do you see moments of upset as opportunities to strengthen relationships? Do you stay annoyed with people who trigger your emotions? Do you ignore people relationally when their emotions are not in sync with yours? That's a typo right there. You can put a C on that. Number eight, do you help your group maintain an identity that is resilient in the face of difficulty? Enduring hardship well. The key to enduring hardship is adequate joy capacity. I may have a skill, but how developed is it? Am I able to handle a certain amount of pressure and still act like myself? How much stress does it take? That's my husband. How much stress does it take for you to avoid relationships? Number two, how much pressure can you handle before you snap and turn into another person? How much can you handle before you disappear and turn to your cravings for comfort? And the next one is Sally rescuing Colleen's car in a snowstorm. That's Sally down there in the... How much stress did it take for you, Sally? No. I know you. Yeah. Review. Maturity grows in a group. Two, leadership is learned. Most leaders focus on getting results rather than focusing on relationships. Leadership is not the same as management. Leadership is about creating engagement by the whole team. Leadership understands that engagement grows out of our group and individual identity. Identity is a powerful motivation that can be overtaken by fear to create dangerous people. Identity can also be fueled by joy, which is greater than fear and can transform the world. To be a gentle protector, we must allow Yeshua, the gentle protector, to live his life through and with us. questions. Everybody knows how to be a gentle protector now. You know how to form some great white matter habits in your brain and how to get your relational circuits back on when you're triggered. And right? We got this. With the Lord's help. Suzanne was talking yesterday about how this is her third time going through this and how much more she's learned the third time around than the first two. And I got to say, for me, teaching it, same is true. Same thing. Yeah, a little less triggered the third time around. Right. All right. Let's look. Go back in your book because we've been skipping around. Go back to page 66. I want to highlight page 66. Healing from grief. You can't change your life until you change your mind. That's a neuroscientist quote. I've talked about the new MRI they have now. It's called the 7T MRI scan. And that's where they've gotten all this new neuroscience information from that machine. Here's some of the bullet points that they've learned just recently. Negative thoughts increase blood flow to the amygdala, the emotional parts of the brain where anxiety and depression live. So if you struggle with anxiety and depression, you need to be, it would be real important for you to be super aware of any negative thoughts that you're thinking, because they increase the blood flow to your amygdala, which is your fear center. Remember the fireman PowerPoint I showed you of the amygdala releasing the fireman to put the fire out? So that's the last thing you want to happen, is to send more blood to your amygdala, because that will increase anxiety and depression. Positive, happier thoughts cause increased blood flow to the areas of your brain that produce helpful neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin, the chemicals of happiness in your brain. So if you find yourself depressed, feeling anxiety, change what you're thinking to positive, happier thoughts. It's a scientific fact that you can change your brain by changing your thoughts. And that's what the Bible tells us in Philippians 4:8. It says, finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. Inside your head is the world's fastest supercomputer. It's estimated that you have between 100 billion to 1 trillion neurons and supporting cells. If those cells didn't communicate with one another, your brain would be useless. What makes the brain so amazing is its vast network of trillions of connections called synapses. Synapses are specialized connections between two or more cells. They allow the cells to talk to each other, to coordinate numerous functions and tasks. They build networks and create little computer programs that run our body systems without us having to think about them, like how we breathe while we're sleeping. But synapses also trigger memories, drive emotional responses, and create physiological reactions to situations. healthy synapses keep your nervous system functioning well. They control everything you do, think, and feel. Every organ in your body is influenced by synapses between the cells. Synapses trigger a happy feeling when you get a bonus at work. They can even program you to try as hard the next time so you will receive the same reward. But synapses can also make you sick, and they can cause major problems in your body and mind. Sick synapses, which are negative attitudes and traumatic memories that get triggered, are a recipe for disaster. When this happens, I must look at my attitude and ask, do I want to continue feeling miserable, grumpy, depressed, angry, etc., which makes everyone else around me feel lousy, or do I want to feel better? You do have a choice. You can change your thinking. The MRI test results are clear. If you change your thoughts, you will change, and so will your attitude and your outlook on life, because thoughts become things. That's so important for us to remember. All right. Any questions, comments on that one? Good. Okay, Greg, I'm going to need a PowerPoint put up for me. We're going to turn to page 34 now. No, we didn't do page 34. Three, four. Processing trauma with the brain Yahweh gave us. Is that the one? Yay, thank you. Okay, some of this on this section we've already gone through, and so we're going to skip as we need to. So, processing trauma with the brain Yahweh gave us. People have asked me a number of times, why do we need to look at the past? I'm doing just fine. My life's good, so why in the world do I need to look at the past? And that's a good question. When we encounter a painful event, our brain works really hard to process that painful experience, and it goes through very specific processing tasks that must be completed if that pain's going to be healed. If this doesn't happen, your brain will store the painful event as trauma. So, this slide here, you can see the system. You have a traumatic event. It overwhelms the physical and psychological systems. You'll feel intense fear, helplessness, or horror. You respond to that trauma, either fight, flight, freeze, or dissociate, altered state of consciousness. You may have body sensations, numbing, hypervigilance, hyperarousal. Sensitized nervous system changes in the brain happen. Current stress happens, and it reminds you of that trauma. We've already talked about that, implicit, explicit memories, painful emotional state. So, and at the bottom, we see if you retreat, isolation, dissociation, depression, anxiety. If you choose self-destructive behavior, substance abuse, eating disorders, deliberate self-harm, suicidal actions, or destructive action would be aggression, violence, and rages. So those are some of the symptoms, the bottom that people choose. And we all choose one of those ways to respond to our emotional upset, unless we've become trained to run to Yahweh, to Yeshua, and that he's our safe tower and he's the one we go to. And so the brain has these five steps here that the pathway needed to process painful events look like this. Number one, if you're going to process trauma, number one, you must maintain a secure attachment with somebody, either Yahweh, Yeshua, the Holy Spirit, a person with skin on, but you must maintain a secure attachment in the midst of the painful memory or event. I mean, this is true if you have an event that happens and you can maintain that secure attachment while that painful event is happening, it won't become trauma. Number two, you must stay relational. In other words, you must stay in it. You can't check out. You can't ignore it or excuse it or blame. Number three, you must stay connected to the event, the pain, the memory. Number four, we must navigate the situation in a Christ-like manner. And number five, we must correctly interpret the painful experience. And that takes the Lord helping us see the truth and know the truth. If we're able to complete those five steps, then the painful experience will not traumatize you. Successfully processing a painful experience means you don't stuff it, forget it, or think about something else, or go eat it away or numb it with some substance or pleasure or shopping or whatever, right? We actually stay in it, go through the five steps above. And as a result, if you do that, like I said, that painful event will not become trauma. And you'll grow stronger, wiser, and more mature. If it's not adequately processed, even a minor event can result in trauma. When memories of the event are not processed fully, it will contain toxic content. One of those toxins found in your dendrite, in your brain, dendrites are where you store memories, is called mycotoxins. And mycotoxins are the greatest cancer-causing substance in our bodies. So when people say, why should I bother with inner healing? Well, there's one reason right there. Because if you have unprocessed trauma in your brain, it contains, that file contains mycotoxins, which is not good. Right? Implicit memory and triggers. We've talked about these already. So you have long-term memory, and long-term memory contains explicit, that's conscious memories that you're aware of, and implicit, those are unconscious memories that you're not aware of. You've forgotten them. So when you're triggered, these implicit memories can come forward without you being aware of it. And like we've said, when your response is out of proportion to what just happened, the result of that is most likely you have an implicit memory that's come forward and you're not aware of it. triggers are your friend. That's a saying I've said for years. And the reason is because when you're triggered, it lets you know you have unhealed trauma somewhere in your brain. And it's unresolved. And it needs to be resolved. If you will resolve it, your brain will actually dump the mycotoxins out of that dendrite, and your body will flush it away. And you'll be healthier and much happier. So many things can trigger us, things, situations, people, places. And then you've got the you in the center and the emotional triggers that are there. And here's what I was talking about earlier. Another aspect of our triggers has to do with the fact that most of us don't really want to know just how dysfunctional we really are. We don't want to see just how often we're triggered. And we don't want to acknowledge just how many of our perceptions, thoughts, and emotions are actually implicit memories coming from unresolved trauma in our past. And we don't want to see just how many of our explanations are actually VLE confabulations trying to justify our triggered reactions. So we ignore our overreactions and blame others for our pain. That is not Christ-like. And we've already talked about the VLE, so I'm not going to go over that again. I think you guys got that one pretty good, right? I'll share this example. When I was a child, I spilled a glass of tea and got suffered abuse as a result of doing that. And then as an adult, Danny and I were at some friend's house, and I actually accidentally spilled a glass of tea walking through the kitchen in her house, and I literally froze in place. I couldn't move. I couldn't think. I was on hyper alert, waiting for the yelling, and then waiting for the blow to come. And that was an implicit memory that came flying forward and put me back to being 7 years old or whatever age I was. So our VLE is designed to protect us and instantly come up with an explanation. And so as I realized I wasn't going to get hit, I'm standing there, and I know I need to explain what's going on, right? And my VLE just helped me right out, and I made up some crazy ridiculous story, and I knew it was ridiculous, and they knew it was ridiculous, but I couldn't stop it. So, let's skip on that page. Let's go to page 17 now. Our relationship with the Lord, the most important takeaway from all of this that we've been talking about is the fact that implicit memories and the VLE confabulated stories can affect our relationship with the Lord in the same way it affects our relationship with others. 37. I might have. If we are triggered with the Lord, then this can result in traumatic implicit memory and VLE confabulations being transferred onto Him. Depending on our past traumas, we may see the Lord as mostly angry, distant, uncaring, unloving. If so, when we need His help, we will confabulate a story explaining why He isn't helping or why we won't even ask for His help. And Nancy shared a real good example of transference from her relationship with her biological father and Yahweh as father earlier. That was transference, and exactly what this is talking about. And it's, you don't plan on doing it, it just happens. Your brain just does it, right? It's not intentional. I believe the most important reason we should seek inner healing is because it removes the blockages and hindrances that keep us from being in the presence of the one who longs to be with us. And the second reason is because healing removes the blockages and hindrances that keep us from being able to love others the way Yahweh loves them. After facilitating thousands of encounters through the years, I'm convinced if we can't perceive Yahweh's presence, it's because there's something in us blocking him, because the Lord always wants to be with us. And we have here on page 37 an exercise for y'all to do in your own time. I strongly encourage you to take the time to do it. It can be eye-opening for you. And page 38, again, I'm going to encourage you to read 38. And we're going to look at page 39, the healing process. I've come to realize that the trauma I experienced as a child was not my problem. I always thought it was. And I blamed so much of my dysfunction and pain on that. But I came to learn that the truth is, the real problem isn't what was done to me or us, but what we believe to be true as a result of what was done. That is the biggest problem. Those lies caused me to build strongholds and to develop quite a fortress of ways to protect myself from people. Fear, for me, became my God. I didn't know it, I didn't realize it, but it was true. To be free and restored, I needed to know. That word know means to experience the truth. I needed to experience Yeshua himself as the truth. And we've already talked about transference. Here's an example of that, another in my life. Often unresolved traumatic memories come forward as invisible, implicit memory are transferred onto others. For example, because my earthly dad was blatantly unfaithful to my mom, I feared, amen. Tell him all about it. Because my earthly dad was unfaithful to my mom, I feared and expected that Danny would be unfaithful. At the end of every day, I would question him over and over about who he talked to that day, etc. That went on for years, and I was just waiting for the day when I discovered that he'd been unfaithful. My implicit memories were keeping me in prison. It wasn't about Danny. He wasn't the one that had the problem. It was me. Yet I believed it was him. So I didn't do anything about me. I had no idea what was going on. So easy for us to transfer the toxic content of implicit memories onto others and onto the Lord. For example, if our father was absent, angry, violent, abusive, etc., it's so easy to transfer that onto the Lord. And I never resolved my fear that Danny would be unfaithful until the Lord healed my heart from how what happened with my dad and my mom. And then I was free. I was like, oh, okay. You know, and poor Danny, you know, because he was just so kind. He was so, he never told me, would you just stop? I just kept asking him. I just kept, and he kept telling me the truth. No, 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 I'm no, no, no. So, encountering the Lord. I love this little cartoon. Wouldn't it be easier if you left that behind? Yes. Encountering the Lord is the number one method we use to not only heal traumas from our past, but the thing I love most about God encounters is the bonding and relationship that happens between the one receiving the God encounter and the Lord. Every memory that gets healed means you're one step closer to putting the past behind you. And the truth is, none of us will be finished with all of our traumatic memories until we're with the Lord. Because, you know, this world is just hard. It's just hard. On the best days, it's still hard, especially when you compare it to what's ahead of us. You know, what's ahead of us is perfection. And who was it telling me that story today about their child hearing about, oh, it was Dee telling me about Lacey, that when I was teaching on the book of Revelation, and Lacey, after I got to the part about the thousand-year reign and Yeshua and all the saints will come back to the earth for 1,000 years, Lacey says to Dee, you mean we got to come back here? No, why? No. You know, but yeah, that's the right perspective. So anyway, on our best days, it's going to be terrible compared to what we have to look forward to. But it's all good, right? Has a purpose. Encountering Yahweh is easier the more we believe that Yahweh is always with us and that he wants to be with us. Remember, that's what joy is all about. And that he wants to help us. If we're unable to perceive his presence or receive his help, it's because there's something on our side that's in the way. And if we believe those truths, then when a traumatic memory presents itself subconsciously and a present-day trigger and our VLE explanation feels real, true, and valid, then we will be able to stop ourselves from responding in a harmful way by recognizing and acknowledging them for what they really are. Then we can choose to change our behavior if we truly believe that Yahweh is always with us and he will help us and heal our pain. Amen. And then I have on page 40 an overview of Encounter God session. We'll skip that because you've all experienced a GE already. Resolving underlying trauma and triggers. There's two questions that are really helpful, especially if you're getting stuck. But I encourage you, instead of focusing on what triggers you, you can choose to surrender and all those accusations and the confabulated story that you're telling yourself, and turn to the Lord and ask these two questions. What am I doing that's preventing me from perceiving your presence? And number two, what do I need to do to be able to take the next step forward? Those two questions are very effective in opening the door for breakthrough and healing. Okay, let's skip on over now. And page 42. And this again is talking about the healing pathway. I want to share this, another example from my life on implicit memory and how powerful it can affect you. When I was about 7 years old, my mom told myself and my older brother and sister. I don't think my other sister was born yet, but she told us she was going to pick us up from school that day, which was unusual. And my three cousins were also going to ride home with us. So she told us to stay after school by the bike rack until she got there to pick us up. So I've always been a rule follower. It's in my DNA. So she said, go stand by the bike rack. So it's pouring down rain when school's over. And I go out in the pouring down rain, and I stand by the bike rack and waiting for my mom. Well, I didn't realize it, but my mom came, and my brother and sister and all the cousins didn't go out by the bike rack. They weren't there. I was all by myself. They stayed under the awning at the front of the school, and my mom drove up, and they hopped in the car, and she never noticed that I didn't get in, and she drove home. And I stood there, and I stood there, and I stood there, and I'm crying, and I'm cold, and I'm wet, soaked. And finally, my mom gets home, and one of the other kids said, where's Rhonda? And my mom looks around and goes, uh-oh. So they all pile back in the car and drive back to the school to pick me up. And when she gets there, my mom is frustrated and upset and wanted to know why I was standing by the bike rack in the pouring down rain and why didn't I, and I'm just crying and you told me to stand by the bike rack. And so I get in the car and my brother and sister and cousins just start making fun of me. They start laughing. You stupid girl, you're standing out in the rain. I mean, just mocking me. And I'm just, anyway, it was not a pleasant situation. So fast forward. I was 7. Let's go. I'm probably 33 or something years old. And as an adult, I was very introverted and only had one or two friends at a time. I just didn't have a big capacity for people. And so this one of my friends asked me if I'd like to go shopping about an hour away with her and another friend. And I thought, okay. So I decided to go. And they invited another friend. And so there was 4 of us. That was a little bit more than my capacity, but I managed. And we stopped on the way for lunch. And then I go in the bathroom after we eat lunch, and they all decided to play a prank on me. And they ran out of the restaurant, got in the car, and drove off. So I come out. They're not there. I go outside thinking they're in the car, and I stop on the curb where we had parked, and the parking space is empty. And instantly, I turned into that little 7-year-old girl that nobody came to pick her up. I mean, instantly, and I'm frozen. I'm just standing there. We didn't have cell phones back then. And I feel all this fear, and I'm not noticed. I'm not seen. My mom didn't even notice I wasn't there. And they've left without me. They didn't even notice I wasn't in the car. I mean, it just like, whew. I didn't know that's what was happening at the time. And then, so I'm just standing there crying, and then I don't know how long it was. I have no idea. Then they come driving up and throw open the back door, and I don't even know how I got in the car. I get in the car, shut the door. And they're laughing, just like my cousins and my brother and sister. They're laughing at me. And I am just still stuck at being a 7-year-old. And, I couldn't speak. I couldn't move. I'm shaking. I felt powerless. And, it's okay for a 7-year-old to be crying, but a grown woman crying, you know, that just wasn't okay. And so I couldn't, I'm sitting in the back seat of that car as a grown woman, and I'm trying to think, why won't they stop laughing? Can't they see that I'm not okay? And I go back to 7 years old. Can't they see that I'm not okay? And, it, you know, I didn't figure that one out until actually when I was studying implicit memory. And that pops in my head. I go, ah, that's what that was. That's why that was. Do you know, I never went shopping with them ever again. And they were innocent. They were innocent. Had I not been traumatized the way I'd been, somebody else would have thought that was funny. Some people would. Like all three of the people in the car thought that would have been funny if it had happened to them. They didn't have that trauma background. So when they realized that I wasn't okay, because they finally did, to me it seemed like a long time. It probably was just minutes. You know, they apologized. But I was stuck. And they didn't have what it took to help me get unstuck. It wasn't their fault. But that is an example of how powerful these unprocessed traumatic memories can be. Once I realized what it was, I went back in, let the Lord tell me the truth. He healed me. He showed me he was there with me. And he just picked that little wet, muddy girl up and loved on her, and everything was fine. Somebody could do that to me now today, and it would not have the same impact. And some people, I wouldn't ever do it to anybody because of my experience. So, but anyway, so that was just an example. Hopefully I didn't trigger anybody by that story. There's two things that the MRI, 7T MRI shows that will retrain your brain. That if you want to retrain your brain, these two things are how you do it. Number one, I don't think this is in your booklet. Number one, you must have a strong emotional experience. And you get that from Yeshua. I had a strong emotional experience in that bike rack in the rain. And it took a strong emotional experience with Yeshua to get that thing healed and covered over. Now I have the memory of Yeshua being with me there that has overpowered that traumatic memory. And number two, you must have a safe relational presence. It takes those two things to rewire your brain. So if you've got a situation that you know needs rewiring like I did, those two things are what you ask the Lord for. Lord, I need to experience you in an emotional way, not just somebody telling me what a Bible verse. And that can be, you know, he can hand you a Bible verse, and like you had, he hands you a Bible verse, and man, it's strong emotional experience with that. I've had those. But that's the difference. When it comes from him, it comes with that life on it. But if it's just some rote thing, you know, it's not going to have the power to transform you. And then to know that you're safe in a I'm glad to be with you way. Those are the two things that are necessary. A safe relational presence. And both of those come from Yahweh encounters. Or you can have Yahweh encounters reading your Bible. You can have Yahweh encounters talking to somebody. they say a sentence and poof, you know, or a billboard on the side of the road. I've had that happen where, wow, the Lord just spoke to me. Or you name it. It can be, he's talking all the time if we have eyes to see, out in the garden or with a horse or with the bees or you name it, wherever. He's always wanting to speak. All right, we're going to skip the infant's external control because we've already covered that about the emotional maturity levels. That's what that one's about. And I just got to show this cute little baby girl right here for the infant, sweetie. And that whole subject there on page 43 is about what we just talked about, being an adult but having an infant maturity level. And for that, here's this slide that you missed out on. It's not appropriate for adults to be infant maturity levels, right? Yeah. We're gonna switch it fast and choose kindness. I know, right? So let's move on to relational circuits. We've talked about those, but not in depth, on page 45. So relational circuits are part of this right hemisphere of your brain where you are able to connect with other people. And when your brain circuits are functioning the way Yahweh designed, then you're going to feel relationally connected if somebody wants to be connected to you. Now, somebody could offer emotional connection to you, but your circuits are offline. And they can try until they're blue in the face, and it won't happen because your brain won't allow it to happen. The problem is that when we get triggered, those relational circuits go offline. And you're no longer able to be in relational mode. And that's where I talk about the Great Wall of China comes down between your left and right hemisphere. And you're either going to be full on right brain pretty much or full on left brain pretty much. And that's not how Yahweh planned for us to function. That's good for a moment, like, it serves its purpose. Let's say you're a man and men tend to trigger into their left brain where their logic, reason, fast acting, they don't have to spend a lot of time thinking because their brain's already thinking and solving problems. And so when you get a coyote that shows up trying to steal your chickens, a man is going to be that fast on it, done. A woman's going to go right brain, pretty much scream, yell, throw a rock or something, or run, depending on how you respond. So there's a purpose for it. Now, some people live triggered they live in a state of being triggered, and their right and left hemisphere is always inaccessible. And that's exhausting, by the way. There are people that have lived that way for years and years and years. And if it's a man, they'll tend to be full on logic, reason, fix, work, do, task, and hardly any emotions, and won't be able to connect emotionally and relationally. That's very difficult, and it's exhausting. And it's exhausting for everybody in the relationship. It's exhausting for the person. But then the same is true for women. We can live in a state of being triggered in our right hemisphere where we aren't very reasonable or logical or don't have the left brain management skills and just become flighty or full-on emotional mess, right? So neither one is healthy or good for you or anybody else. And so, but now it's interesting because I read some brain studies on this dynamic where people have suffered brain damage, and it caused that where they cannot access, in this these two cases I read about, two men that had brain damage from accidents, and they could not access their right brain for emotions at all, and they were just left brain. And so that was pretty sad, you know, to read it. But Yahweh created us to have both hemispheres working together simultaneously, right? Relational checklist. I want to look at that. Actually, let's look at this secure attachment, because I referred to the secure attachment a lot, but I didn't really describe it much. If a child formed secure attachments and had relational connections to joy, then there's Sarah and Juliana, and there's secure attachment style. So if a child formed secure attachments and had relational connections to joy, then that child will have the ability to be unmoved when faced with people who are upset and attacking them. And you can form secure attachments as an adult. In the same way that traumatic content can come forward as implicit memory, content from your personal relational memories can come forward as implicit memory as well. Even if people are criticizing and falsely accusing me, the content from my positive relational memories can come forward as implicit memory so that it will feel true in the present and I won't get triggered. I will stay secure. I'll have a strong foundation of joy. I'm glad to be with you anyway. And I'm able to say to myself, you might feel this way, but my family loves me. The church I'm part of loves me. They understand me. They're glad to be with me. And I'm glad to be with them. And the Lord loves me. So you do that self-talk. So anyway, that will keep you from losing your relational circuits where that great wall of China won't come down if you have that secure attachment. It's a big deal. Dr. James Wilder, he found that checking whether a person can feel appreciation when thinking about positive memories is one of the simplest and most accurate ways to determine if you're in relational mode or not. So if you're wondering whether or not your relational circuits are on or off, if you are talking to somebody and you're wondering, am I in relational mode or am I just listening? Picture in your mind a memory of that person that you're talking to, and in that memory of that person, can you feel appreciation for them? And I'd say in love. And I've done it. I've done this test because I like to test things. And it's true. It really does let you know, and it's quick. It's faster than I'm going to give you the relational circuit checklist. It's longer. But that simple right there, do I feel appreciation for this person and love for them? And if I don't feel like I could say, oh, I'm so thankful this person's in my life, and I'm so glad that I get to do this with them, and I love them. If I can't do that, my relational circuit's probably not on. So the things that can cause your circuits to shut down, if you feel angry or anxious, if you're in conflict, if you feel judgmental, if you feel irritated, when you realize you lack joy, your circuits are off. When you're feeling bad for any reason, your circuits are probably offline. If my circuits are offline, I will feel weak, small, insecure, alone, vulnerable, ultimately unsafe, unable to care for myself. If your circuits are offline, you will fight to protect yourself instead of engaging in constructive communication. But that will all change if you get back in relational mode. So here's a bunch of questions you can ask yourself to determine whether or not your relational circuits are on. And like I said, some people have lived years and years and years and years with their relational circuits offline. And it's a lonely, painful way to live. It's not at all the way we were made to live. Uh-huh. Question. Does this apply when you're by yourself as well, these offline feelings? Or is it just when you're with somebody?
If you're by yourself and trying to connect with the Lord, yeah. If you're by yourself and just by yourself. Well, that was that one. Low battery. All right, on page 48 and 49, you're going to see some ways to get your relational circuits back online. And in a nutshell, I'll tell you what they are. Attunement, attunement, attunement. Somebody somewhere attunes to you. Somebody's glad to see you, glad to be with you. They understand where you're at. They join you in your emotions. And they listen. Here's some pictures from farm life from years ago. Isn't that fun? And there's some more fun pictures. Judging others. I want to talk about this one on page 50. When I judge someone, I'm saying I'm better than someone else and that I would have done things differently if I had the same obstacles and challenges that they had. When I judge, I'm believing the other person did bad in some way. When I judge another person, my relational circuits are offline. That's an indicator. If you're judging somebody in your thoughts or in your heart, you're not in relational mode. Mm-hmm. It is pride. When I judge someone, I make negative assumptions about another person's motives, and you can't know somebody's motives unless they tell you. You can't. You can see their actions, but you don't know their motives. And Yeshua said, Luke 6:37, do not judge, and you will not be judged. And do not condemn, and you will not be condemned. Pardon, and you will be pardoned. And 1 Peter 5:5-7. You younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders, and all of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you. And it doesn't get any better than that. Amen. Any questions, thoughts, observations? Good. Everybody's good? Okay. Deborah. You got a mic, Al?
I was looking. I just been thinking some more about the VLEs and stuff. we all have our own, and I know that, but I think growing up, I'm realizing there are people that also had VLEs about different situation, and even used like religion and the prophetic with their VLEs. I mean, I got to take care of me, and I know that, but it's just kind of like eye-opening that, like, how that can affect even in the body of Christ.
It sure can. And the sad thing is, you don't know it. The person doesn't know it.
I started grief counseling before I came here, and one of the things that she talked about was, you know, just processing with someone. She said if you're by yourself, it helps to process actually out loud. And she said it's even better if you process with another person. And then she talked about this research where a person received an electrical shock, and it was very, very painful. And then somebody held their hand, and they received the electrical shock. And they said, oh, well, that wasn't nearly as painful, but it was the same amount of shock. But because they were holding someone's hand, it didn't affect them the same way.
Wow. I could believe that. Aloneness is very painful to humans. Very painful. Anybody else? Dorothy?
I thought about this for a little while on page 169, acting like yourself, assessment questions. And the first sentence, we act like ourselves when we live out the best version of who we are. In this other journal study program, there's a page and it says how to be your best version. What is that? And it asks you to describe different attributes that you think of yourself on the best day that you feel really on target, you feel relational, and what does that look like, and use the words to describe it. And so, you know, understanding, caring, compassionate, creative, loving, kind. And we were instructed to write those down and to keep that in mind when we're thinking of our best version of ourselves, and checking on that as we relate to people. Are we in that mode? And I found that really helpful. It was labeled under to be. How are we being our best version, not doing, being our best version. And I found that helpful.
Okay. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for today. We ask that you would sign, seal, and deliver what you've poured into us today. We ask that you bless our time together this evening and tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day until you come back again. And Lord, come soon, please. And you amen.
Hey, everybody. Tomorrow is Friday. And we are going to be